This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at the politics behind the so-called Russiagate.
I think you can sum it up in one term: hysteria. There's no evidence whatsoever that's been provided that this is what occurred.
We also take a look at the issue of government agencies asking tech giants such as Apple and Google to turn over private data from activists who were arrested.
This is right out of 1984. Listeners will remember that the TV sets they had in 1984 actually spied on you. Are there ways to protect yourself? Listen in.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, what's your take on Neil Gorsuch as the possible next Supreme Court justice?
He'll certainly get Senate approval, and he'll replace Anton Scalia as the next ninth justice on the Supreme Court. He greatly, greatly admired Scalia. He said that when he heard the news that Scalia had died, he was skiing. He was going down a ski slope at the time. He said he teared up so much that it was hard for him to ski. Well, I don't diminish anyone's death, but I have to say I didn't shed any tears for Scalia. Scalia was a man who caused a lot of misery. The man that Gorsuch greatly, greatly admires was a member of Opus Dei. Opus Dei was a extremely right-wing Catholic clerical organization founded by a pro-fascist priest in Spain in the mid-30s. You'll recall that it was the fascist government in Spain, aided by Hitler and Mussolini, that overthrew the democratic government in that country. Opus Dei has existed from the 30s to this day, doing reactionary work around the globe. Scalia, who Gorsuch greatly, greatly admires, was a supporter of the death penalty. He said that God supported the death penalty. He supported the death penalty for a 15-year-old. He even supported the death penalty when there was objective evidence that the man who was about to be executed was innocent. I remember Bill Kunstler saying at the time that any society that would countenance that is a decadent society. And Gorsuch, like Scalia, supports the judicial doctrine of originalism. Originalism holds that a judge, in interpreting the law, should look to the original intent of the founding fathers. And they were all men, the founding fathers. They wrote the Constitution 223 years ago in Philadelphia in 1791. So for a judge to say that they can divine the intent of these men who wrote the Constitution in 1791, when we had an agrarian rural society, a slave society, a society that had not yet developed the modern corporation, a society that did not rule over the entire planet with 900 military bases in almost every country in the world, for them to say that they can divine what was in the minds of these men in 1791 is a sham. But what is it used for? The originalists are inclined to support the very right-wing positions of the Republican Party. For example, corporate financing of elections, commercial advertising, gun rights, opposing African-American rights, opposing gay rights, and even, many people are afraid, opposing the established right now of abortion. There are rights that are not written into the Constitution that are recognized today. Those rights are in danger. What rights am I talking about? The extension of the Bill of Rights to the states and local governments, for example. The right to travel. The right to privacy. The right to freedom of association. None of these rights are mentioned in the original document of 1791. When Gorsuch was a freshman at an elite private Catholic high school, a prep school in Washington, D.C., he founded an organization called Fascism Forever. And he kept that organization going for 4 years. The poet Milton observed that childhood shows the man as morning shows the day. So I don't think we should expect, nor do I think we're going to get anything good out of Gorsuch. When he worked for the Justice Department in 2005 and 2006, He worked to oppose laws that would have banned torture in Guantanamo. He worked to oppose laws that would have given the prisoners in Guantanamo the right to habeas corpus to challenge their imprisonment. And he supported warrantless surveillance. When Chief Justice John Roberts was questioned before becoming the head of the Supreme Court, he assured the senators that he was there only to call balls and strikes. That's his term, is famous now. He was only there to call balls and strikes. He wasn't going to be any kind of judicial activist. And then what did he do? Roberts wrote the decision in Citizens United, which held that a corporation is a person and has all the rights to donate money to political parties. Jimmy Carter, who knows about this, observed that the United States is no longer a democracy, it's an oligarchy. The huge amounts of money that pour into the two major parties are a result of Roberts' decision, the guy that calls balls and strikes in Citizens United. Corporations are not people. I mean, I'll believe a corporation's a person the day it gets a colonoscopy. And just to conclude, last week, David Rockefeller died. He was 101 years old. He was the last grandchild of the great robber baron John D. Rockefeller. And the New York Times described him as a philanthropist. What would be most accurate to describe David Rockefeller would be an oligarch. It was David Rockefeller, who was one of the people who helped support the installation of Pinochet, set up a fascist government in Chile, who wiped out Chilean democracy. He's an oligarch. And that's the kind of society that Scalia supported, that Gorsuch supports. It's a society of the elite, of the rich. It's a hierarchical society. It's an authoritarian society. And that's the kind of thing that I think we can expect from Justice Gorsuch.
On an issue that I know is near and dear to you, can you tell our listeners what the situation is in New York State regarding visitation rights for maximum security prisoners?
Would all of our listeners please help me out here? Get a pen. I'm going to give you the phone number of Governor Cuomo. Cuomo plans to reduce visiting hours at New York State's maximum security prisons. And I'd like you to help join me in opposing this cutback. Cuomo has proposed to limit visiting hours at New York State maximum security prisons to 3 days a week instead of the current seven. If passed, this measure will cause suffering and separation for thousands of imprisoned people and their loved ones. Restricting visits is regressive, counterproductive, and cruel. You can call Governor Cuomo and voice your protest at 518-474-8390. We'll post this phone number on lawanddisorder.org, as well as the phone numbers of seven other people associated with the government that could help stop this. It's particularly cruel. I'm planning to visit a friend in prison up in Buffalo. It's 460 miles away from New York City. So it's a hardship for people in New York City just to get up there. And that's where these prisons are, mainly. They're way up in rural areas in New York. But it'd be a double hardship if you could only go up there 3 days a week. You can imagine the crowding and the difficulty. So this is a measure that's supposed to save a little over $2 million. It's a false economy. These prisoners need support. They need love. They need attention. They need something to grasp onto when they get out. And to cut off their visiting days is cruel. Please help out. 518-474-8390. Myths of what has been referred to as Russiagate. The Democrats, with their neoconservative allies and most of the major media, are alleging, with no proof, that President Trump has been in collusion with Russia, and specifically that Russia helped tilt the election in his favor. Mainstream journalist and New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman has, for example, compared the alleged Russian hacking of the Democratic Party emails to be another Pearl Harbor or another 9/11. This hysteria is extraordinarily dangerous, and as much as Trump may be put into a position of confronting Russia, the other major nuclear power in the world. We speak today with Washington, D.C. investigative journalist Robert Perry. He has covered Washington for nearly four decades. One of the many important stories he broke was on the Iran-Contra scandal. Robert Perry's latest book is America's Stolen Narrative, From Washington and Madison to Nixon, Reagan, and the Bushes to Obama. Robert Perry, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
What are the politics behind Russiagate? What position has Trump taken on Russia, and who are the people who oppose him on this?
Well, I think there are several things at play here. You have, first, the more short-term political issue of many progressives, Democrats, liberals, disdaining Trump, wanting to see him removed from office, if at all possible. So there's a certain opportunism that the Russia issue presents, that it is something where Trump can be portrayed as unpatriotic and possibly even treasonous. It also helps some of the Hillary Clinton supporters justify her failed campaign. They can say, well, it wasn't her fault. It was Russia's fault working with Trump. So I think you have that kind of more short-term aspect to it. And there are longer-term components as well. In a sense, Trump marks what could be the end of the unipolar period following the end of the Cold War up through the Iraq War and the long Afghan War and the various regime change operations that even occurred under Obama, that recognizes that the United States has overextended itself, that the world is changing, that you're getting into what might be seen more as a multipolar world with China and Russia and other countries asserting themselves more. And so there's an understandable attitude, I guess, among people in Washington who have been used to running the world, that they don't like that demonization of their powers. They don't want to accept that they can't do what they've gotten used to doing over the last quarter century. So I think you're seeing several things at play here. And in that regard, that it might explain, for instance, why people like Senator McCain or Senator Lindsey Graham have been so hostile to Trump on these issues as well, because they want to continue the approach that we've seen over the last over this last period of the United States being the global policeman for the world and deciding which governments can stay, which governments must go, and then enforcing that either through military means or through so-called soft power, i.e. subverting governments with propaganda and political activities and doing color revolutions. So I think Trump is in a way saying that the U.S. can no longer afford that. So he's that's more of a longer-term kind of reason why I think these issues have been picked up so aggressively by some.
Robert Perry, is there something to the charge that Trump colluded with Putin against Clinton? What evidence is there that U.S. intelligence services offered to show that Russian intelligence took Democratic Party emails and gave them to WikiLeaks for publication?
Well, that's been my problem as a journalist. What I'm trained to do as an investigative reporter is to examine evidence and to evaluate it. In this case, and I've pressed various people who I thought could help me on this, but they've not been willing to provide evidence. They say the U.S. intelligence community, at least key parts of it, say they've assessed that the Russians were responsible for hacking these two batches of Democratic emails and then providing them to WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks says they didn't get them from Russians, they got them from Americans. I suppose, as FBI Director Comey suggested in his assessment on Monday, that there could have been intermediaries between the Russians and WikiLeaks to explain why, you know, to explain that. Now, that's certainly possible. It's certainly possible the Russians hacked into these various accounts. The Russians do that, Chinese do that, the United States does that. So a lot of people in the intelligence world now obtain information by hacking into various accounts and other means, too. So the idea that there was some hacking is perhaps not that surprising, but the issue becomes whether or not the Russians would then have shared that with WikiLeaks and then to the public. They've not been willing, the U.S. intelligence community has not been willing to present its evidence, which makes it hard for me or others to evaluate how seriously to take that point. Then there's the second point, which is, was there collusion between the Trump people and the Russians to get them to do this, to sort of assist them or coordinate with them to do this? On that, at least publicly, no evidence has been presented at all. There were contacts or meetings, but no one in the know has no one in Congress or from the law enforcement community or intelligence community has said that there is evidence that those meetings were anything to involve getting the Russians to provide this assistance to the Trump campaign. So you're kind of stuck with, at this point, with sort of a who knows, but usually in that case, we don't just jump to the conclusion someone's guilty. There usually is a presumption of innocence, and certainly in journalistic terms, a sense of fairness, that if you're going to accuse someone effectively of treason, you should have some pretty solid evidence, or at least something you can present that backs up that allegation, not just some suspicions or some circumstantial situations that may or may not mean anything. But that's what we've seen. We saw the lead Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Congressman Schiff, basically ask, is it possible that all these meetings and events were completely unrelated and just a coincidental? And he says, yes, it's possible, but it's also possible, maybe more than possible, that there was something more to them. Well, that's, you know, that is not really a serious presentation of evidence. That's laying out stuff that looks funny or could be taken suspiciously. That's what we generally call conspiracy theory, where some people think, well, I can't understand something, so how about I can explain it maybe this way, but they don't have any evidence to back up their claims. And I've always been very hostile to conspiracy theories. I think they're unfair. They tend to accuse people of things without evidence. They represent, in my way of thinking, lazy thinking and lazy reporting, because instead of digging in to find something out, you just sort of come up with some idea in your head. And I've done many investigations along these lines, national security investigations, and I've always had multiple witnesses, people who were inside the operations, who can explain what they saw, how things worked, who was doing what, before I'd even think about writing a word. And that's just from a journalistic point of view. I wouldn't, you know, that's not a member of Congress getting up and basically accusing a bunch of people of treason. So I think the standards here for evidence have been very lax. And I think and part of the interesting aspect of this, I would say perhaps a sad aspect of this, is that many on the progressive side are so angry about Trump that they don't really care that there's unfairness here. They have no sympathy for any of these targets of this investigation. They want to believe. They want this to be true. They want Trump to be taken down somehow. And so they're not applying the sort of the common standards of evidence and proof and fairness that we would like, I think we'd like to see applied to anybody.
Yeah, really. I mean, what I haven't seen is any description of just how the Russians were supposed to have helped Trump in the election. I know from reading up on this and interviewing Ray McGovern that the stuff that WikiLeaks let out were speeches that Hillary Clinton gave to the banks, and it was some stuff on pay-to-play with the Clinton Foundation. Evidence that the Democratic National Committee helped Clinton as opposed to helping Sanders when they were supposed to be neutral. But none of this explains how the Russians were supposed to have helped Trump get elected.
Well, I mean, I suppose if you accept that the Russians were the ones who provided the information, that could have somewhat hurt Hillary Clinton. But nobody, if you go back, there's sort of a revisionist history being applied here, because if you go back to the actual campaign, nobody thought that those disclosures that occurred earlier, and they, by the way, they were factual. There was nothing false news, fake news about them. It wasn't disinformation. It was real information. And they were things that were somewhat relevant because there was wrongdoing by the DNC, and there was secrecy by Secretary Clinton about not wanting the voters to see her speeches to the Wall Street banks. And so those are legitimate issues actually for the public to know. So there is the question of whether the Russians provided that, but even if they did, nobody thought that those two batches of emails were significant in the campaign. It was Hillary Clinton herself said she lost because FBI Director Comey came out in the last couple of weeks of the campaign and reopened the investigation into her use of a private email server when she was Secretary of State and whether that jeopardized national security. And then he reclosed the investigation just before the election, and that's when her numbers really took a dive. Now, and that's what she understood, and that's what everyone understood at the time. Now, then, but that wasn't, unless you want to think that Director Comey is another Russian mole, which I don't think people are suggesting. Maybe they are, who knows, but that was what really changed the situation and toward the end of the campaign. But then they reached back further and said, oh, well, there's also this other thing, and they started making that the focus. Now, so I think there's a bit of game playing in that, trying to build up something that was relatively insignificant to the campaign into making it decisive in the campaign. So there's just a lot here that is not entirely honest when it comes to how people should handle something as sensitive as this. It's not only the reputations of these various individuals who are being kind of accused without any evidence at all of treason. But it's also that the idea of provoking a deeper confrontation with nuclear-armed Russia is extremely dangerous. You know, the Russians may not take this as a joke. We also have troops on their borders, supposedly to protect these NATO countries that have moved up to their borders. So the Russians are extremely nervous about some of this. And there are these nuclear arsenals in play. And there could be a mistake. There could be a false alarm. And that, who knows what could happen in a time of heightened tension. So not only should you be careful about people's reputations, but you should also be careful about the future of life on the planet and say, you know, before we start charging off in some direction, we better have some evidence here, real evidence, not just playing games with ourselves. But it seems that Washington has decided to play games with itself.
I read your article in Common Dreams, and it was also not just that Comey issued that investigation right before the vote, but Clinton herself ran a poor campaign, and she had no vision. She called people deplorables. I mean, I think that they've got to own that, and they don't. Instead, they're blaming Russia in some vague way for getting Trump elected.
Right. I think that this is a different area, less of my responsibility, but yes, I think the Democrats are finding excuses for themselves. Instead of looking at what happened and doing an honest autopsy of why they did so badly, they ran against someone who many of us considered borderline unelectable and managed to get him elected. And that wasn't just because of whatever may have happened with a couple of email disclosures. This was something that related to those other points, that Hillary Clinton was a very bad candidate. She did not provide a real vision of where she was going to take the country. She ran a highly negative campaign. She was distrusted by a large number of Americans for reasons, some unfair, but some fair. So the Democratic Party itself was not offering, at least in a coherent, obvious way, a message to a lot of Americans who are hurting, especially in the Rust Belt. You know, my wife has family in Ohio. We go through Pennsylvania and Ohio, and you see these people, and you see these towns. It's not made up that some of these places have been deindustrialized and are rusting away, and a lot of those people are in pain. And instead of offering a campaign that of hope that somehow reached them, they offered a campaign that was mostly about ridiculous statements that Donald Trump had made over the years. And I suppose that's part of what you do in a campaign, but you also really should try to explain to people where you want to take the country, and that was lacking. So the Democrats have, in a way, either put off no plan to do it at all, but looking at themselves, looking in the mirror and saying, okay, why did this happen, and what do we have to do differently so to give these voters a reason to support the Democratic Party as opposed to voting for some guy with a basically no real resume at all for this office, who says stuff that isn't even I think doesn't even know if it's true or not, and he's offering them kind of a flim-flam. He promises one thing and does something quite different. He promises health care insurance for all and then supports the Republican proposal that's going to cut health care insurance for all. So how do the Democrats manage to lose to this guy, and what do they have to do differently so they can become a more responsive party and a more one that can get votes? They don't seem to want to deal with that. I've seen very little from the Democratic Party about rethinking their message. Instead, they've sort of been spending the last several months trying to whip up a kind of McCarthyistic investigation that so far has developed no real evidence, but they're still pressing ahead with it because it's somehow politically useful, I guess, in their view.
I don't know. You know, it seems to be a distraction from all the terrible things that Trump and his cabinet are proposing, and instead they've got this discussion about Russiagate. But I wanted to ask you, Robert Perry, what similarities does Russiagate have with past Washington scandals?
Well, there have been other cases. I know some people say this is unprecedented, but it's really not. I mean, even assuming there is something to it, there was a piece in the New York Times on Saturday saying that no president has ever been accused or suspected of working with a foreign adversary to get elected. And whatever you want to say about the so-called October Surprise of 1980 case, certainly there was a substantial evidence that Ronald Reagan's campaign did work with the Iranians behind President Carter's back to sabotage his efforts to free 52 American hostages then held, and that did become a central point in his defeat. So happened that the anniversary of the hostage taking was election day, so there was a huge amount of attention being paid to Carter's failure to get these hostages out, and then we saw the numbers in the last week of the campaign open up, were from a close race between Reagan and Carter to a more or less a landslide for Reagan. So, there is a large volume of evidence that William Casey, then the campaign director and vice presidential nominee George H.W. Bush, were involved in contacts with Iranians to get to undermine Carter's negotiations. We have that even from, for instance, the then president of Iran, Bonnie Sadr. We have it from there was a senior Reagan administration official who looked into this in 1981, Assistant Secretary of State Nick Belliotis, who concluded that the arms shipments that Reagan had approved in early '81 to go to Iran were payments from the deals that were made back in 1980. So there's substantial evidence, you know, literally dozens of sources who took part in this, who have talked and are public about what happened, but it's still been sort of suppressed and dismissed. Now, a similar thing happened in 68, where Richard Nixon was hoping to win the election. He had lost narrowly in 1960, and didn't want that to happen again in 68. So President Johnson was trying to basically bring the Vietnam War to an end. He was setting up peace talks in Paris that he felt could facilitate that. And we now know, and this again is evidence that's extraordinarily detailed and persuasive, that Nixon's team went behind Johnson's back and went to the South Vietnamese government and said, pull out of these peace talks and we will get you we'll continue U.S. military support for the next 4 years. So the South Vietnamese government pulled out of the peace talks, they collapsed. Nixon then continued the war for another 4 more years. And on that one, you know, Johnson knew a great deal about it because the FBI had wiretapped a number of the people involved, and so you had that direct evidence. You also had, subsequently many documents coming out that's also supported that this happened. And even now, the New York Times, which always tends to sort of brush aside all these kinds of cases, even when they're well supported by evidence, has finally just this last couple of months now accepted this as real because there was an additional disclosure or discovery of some Haldeman notes where Nixon sort of makes reference to this. So now I guess we believe that happened, even though it's been proven for quite a few decades. But now that the New York Times has actually even put its stamp of approval on this. So yes, these are sorts of things that happened in the past, and more or less people have gone away with it. Now the issue here is, did anything happen at all? Is this a false version of one of those events? And again, in the two cases we're talking about, in 68, there were 500,000 American soldiers in the war zone in Vietnam, and so the Vietnam War was a huge issue in that campaign. Nixon promised to end it, if you remember. He had a secret plan to end it. In 1980, the Iran hostage crisis was a huge issue. It was being talked about every night, how many days that of American humiliation had followed the capture of these hostages. So those were big deals. Now, by comparison, the release of some actually honest and truthful emails much earlier in the campaign were not anything like that. We're not even sure. There's no evidence that's been shown us publicly, anyway, to support the claim that the Russians did provide that to WikiLeaks. There's no evidence that the Trump people conspired with the Russians to provide that material to WikiLeaks. So it's a much hazier situation in this case. The other two, 68 and 80, there's a vast body of very hard evidence.
Robert Perry, that leads me to this obvious question. In determining which scandals are taken seriously, what's more important, power or truth?
Well, I've been in Washington for 40 years now, and I would say my experience is that power always trumps truth. You might think that, oh, there's this, the news media and the two-party system has all this effort to get to the truth and tell it like it is, but that's just not the way it works in Washington. Hasn't for at least my time here. I came in 1977, so maybe if you go back to the Watergate, Pentagon Papers period that preceded me, you might say, well, it did work somewhat that way in the 70s, but as we moved from that period through the 80s, 90s, and into the new century, what you see is that basically, it doesn't matter almost how much evidence you have of a certain crime of state. If enough powerful people don't want to accept it, it doesn't even get accepted. Another good case is the case of the Contra drug trafficking in the Nicaraguan Contras who were being supported by the CIA under Ronald Reagan also got deeply involved in drug trafficking. There's no doubt about that. The evidence is overwhelming. But it wasn't something that people wanted to believe. And the Reagan people denied it and attacked anyone who brought up the evidence. So it was suppressed. And it's been suppressed pretty much to this day, even when the CIA did an internal investigative report in 1998, confessing to it, it's still not accepted.
So
basically what you see is that evidence and truth often are shoved aside when powerful, popular, political interests go the other way, and when there's not really much of a fight in the part of the mainstream media or the opposition party to dig out the truth, because it can be very dangerous for people. It costs them jobs. They get smeared. They face all kinds of troubles. So what happens usually is people put their careers ahead of any commitment to fully inform the American people what's going on.
What do you think about the situation of Obama tapping Trump's phones in Trump Tower?
Well, like the other stuff, there's been no evidence presented to support it. So when there's no evidence to support something, that doesn't mean it's not true, I suppose. But you have to sort of look at it as if it's has not been proven, has not been supported by evidence, and leave it at that until something comes forward. And President Trump has not been willing to provide evidence to support his claims. He just cites some stuff he heard on TV or something. I would look toward that the same way I look at toward the other material. Until you can back it up with some evidence, why should we take it seriously? I mean, it's one thing to sort of looking at things quietly, but to start making accusations publicly should be avoided unless you have evidence. And as far as where my work is produced for consortiumnews.com, which is a website I sort of founded back in the mid-1990s, and we still operate it. Our stuff is often then picked up by other places, including Common Dreams, often. It originates at consortiumnews.com.
Great. Robert Perry, it's really been a delight to have you on as our guest. We appreciate it. We'd like to check back with you. Just an excellent account about what's been going on here. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Inauguration protests earlier this year, more than 200 people were mass arrested and charged under the Felony Riot Act, punishable by up to 10 years in prison and a $25,000 fine. Those picked up in the sweep, including journalists, medics, and legal observers, had their cell phones, cameras, and other personal belongings confiscated as evidence. Law enforcement agencies are compelling Apple, Facebook, and Google to hand over the personal information of many of those who were arrested. The tech giants appear to be complying or are willing to comply with these data mining requests. Several of those arrested have been contacted by Facebook and Apple and told that their personal information has been requested by the U.S. Attorney's Office. An Apple customer notice to one noted that, quote, Apple will be producing the requested data in a timely manner as required by the legal process. A National Lawyers Guild attorney representing several of the protesters, Mark Goldstone, has said that one of his clients will fight vigorously to prevent the data from being handed over, as the phone was not even present at the demonstration. Joining us to discuss these requests for private electronic information is Stephanie LaCambra, a criminal defense staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Stephanie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
What legal justification has law enforcement given to seize personal electronic information from the protesters?
Law enforcement claims that there's probable cause to believe that there's evidence to support their allegations of felony rioting on protesters' cell phones.
Okay, and what exactly is felony rioting?
Well, under the federal statute, it basically entails a riot that erupts into violence, causing damage to property, people.
At the inauguration, was anyone hurt or was there violence?
Those are the allegations. I'm not familiar enough with the specifics. I've only been working with the defense attorneys insofar as trying to protect the arrestees and their clients' personal digital information.
Exactly. Now, we don't yet know, and correct me if I'm wrong, the scope of information being requested, but what do you think the authorities really want to do with the data, aside from their claims that it's related to the rioting charges?
Well, the authorities also claim that many protesters evaded arrest, so it would seem they wish to mine the personal electronic communications of the people they arrested to see if they can identify the others they believe got away.
Does that possibly involve looking at their lists of contacts, if they have a cell phone?
Absolutely. I would expect that the authorities are keen to get into not just the contact lists, but the contents of the communication to see who the arrestees were communicating with at the protest and see if they can identify other parties whose cell phones and information they don't have yet.
Have the Metropolitan Police Department in the District of Columbia or the U.S. Attorney's Office made any comments about this and the challenges that are being brought to turning over the information?
I have contacted the U.S. Attorney's Office to request the return of digital devices that were seized by District of Columbia Metropolitan Police Department of individuals whose cases had been dismissed. They have been cooperating or in arranging the return of those devices, and I've questioned the Metropolitan Police Department personnel as to why protesters' phones were not released to them with their property when they were originally booked as prisoner property, and they've responded that it's their policy to seize and retain arrestees' cell phones summarily, which I, of course, think is problematic.
Is it accurate that one person's cell phone wasn't actually with that person in D.C.?
There was a subpoena for subscriber information for a number that was not physically present. So they weren't asking for the cell phone, they were asking for the subscriber information of the account related to the cell phone number.
I read that one journalist reportedly took a screenshot of his Google account, and it showed that while he was being detained and the phone was in police custody, there was activity on his account. And the journalist says that his phone is password protected. What do you make of that?
I would caution against being alarmist here. Your Google account automatically refreshes on its own, so I just don't know enough from the screenshot to tell whether this was some kind of nefarious login attempt by law enforcement or automated activity by the account to get the most up-to-date information.
And I also read that an unidentified medic spotted activity on his account while the police was in custody. Would it be speculative to think that the police began mining information from the phones they had in their possession almost immediately after the arrests? And if so, just hypothetically, what would the problems be with that practice?
Well, again, without knowing more about what kind of activity and what kind of settings his phone was on, we can't know if the police were actually trying to mine information from the seized cell phones immediately after the arrests. However, if it later turns out that D.C. Metropolitan Police were using tech like Cellebrite or software like that to extract content information from the seized phones without first obtaining a warrant to do so, this would fly in the face of our Fourth Amendment protections and carry some serious consequences for the viability of that evidence in court.
So there is software, as I understand it, that can extract information. Can it do it remotely?
I'm not aware of software that's able to do it remotely yet. It may exist out there. The only experience I've seen or I've had is with the Cellebrite technology that you physically have to plug into the phone.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But that doesn't mean that they're not developing or haven't already developed technology that allows them to do it remotely.
I understand that an investigation by citylabs.com, which is a project of The Atlantic, revealed earlier, a few weeks ago, that, and I'm quoting here, major police departments around the country are spending millions on cell phone spy tools that can be used to build up massive surveillance databases with few rules about what happens to the data they capture. And this investigation alleges that most of the major police departments across the nation either have cell phone interception devices or cell phone extraction devices, as you alluded to, used to crack open locked phones in police possession. In general, is the Electronic Frontier Foundation handling other cases like this?
We deal with, we constantly are filing amicus briefs in cases where, usually in the criminal defense context, where law enforcement is using technology like this to extract personal information from defendants' digital devices. It really kind of depends on the tool and the context of the extraction. For example, if the police are using technology like Cellebrite to extract a digital copy of a cell phone's contents pursuant to a probable cause warrant, that's sufficiently particularized in the content it seeks and its relevance to an open investigation, there would be an argument to be made that that's perfectly in line with our Constitution. However, if police were using some kind of technology without first obtaining a warrant, then the same act wouldn't comport with constitutional principles. Far worse is the technology like a cell site simulator that commonly known, I guess, as a stingray, that by its very operation offends constitutional safeguards by scooping up information of perfectly innocent bystanders in proximity to a suspect target. And EFF has long warned the public and public officials about the serious threat this kind of technology poses to privacy since we first found out about it. And while we hold firm that the use of cell site simulators are completely incompatible with Fourth Amendment principles, until the vulnerability in cell phone networks is patched that enables the use of this kind of technology, we've been calling and pressuring Congress to regulate law enforcement's use of this kind of tech and to require a probable cause warrant, transparency reports, and limit access and storage of both the target and our non-target data.
Is there a concern about the storage of the data as well, so that we really don't have a way of knowing that if law enforcement does obtain a particularized warrant and it's found to be constitutional, what do they do with the data after they have it?
Well, of course, there's a concern about the large amounts of personal data, and not just by law enforcement, but stored and monetized by, you know, tech giants like Google, Apple, Facebook. I think the bigger issue is really increasing user awareness and sophistication about what information they're giving to these platforms and through these platforms to law enforcement, and being more mindful about how that information will be used and shared with others, especially law enforcement. So if you don't want law enforcement, advertisers, and others getting access to your personal information, you as users have to mobilize around demanding stronger privacy protections from your service providers, supporting candidates who have strong records of writing laws to protect user privacy, and limiting or foregoing use of certain social media platforms if they don't provide sufficient user privacy protections.
We love and are a huge fan here at Law and Disorder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and your website has some wonderful tools and resources for people to start to begin to be more aware of safeguarding personal data. What kinds of pointers would you begin to give to activists, given some of the things we've heard in the recent WikiLeaks disclosures about vulnerabilities, even, I believe, with such encrypted programs as Signal for messaging?
Specifically with Signal and the WikiLeaks leaks, there's no indication in any of the documents from WikiLeaks that were released that the encryption of popular privacy apps such as Signal are broken. We believe that encryption still offers significant protection against dragnet surveillance. So encourage our members and our users to continue to use strong encryption and use apps like Signal. Basically, most of the stuff that came out on the WikiLeaks highlights something that's been pretty well documented. You know, intelligence agencies, including the CIA and many others, can hack their way around encryption by putting malware on devices of specifically targeted people and institutions. But encryption forces spies to select specific targets, spend effort deploying malware against them, and in some cases risk being detected. So we still urge people to continue to adopt strong encryption tools and to use applications that offer strong encryption. For advice for protesters and activists, if you intend to go to a protest, my general advice would be to limit the data you carry by, you know, doing any of a number of things. You can leave your cell phone at home, carry a burner phone, turn your phone on airplane mode or off completely. Definitely log out of any applications or remove any sensitive information from your device. Use encryption. Each of these tools, each of these steps carries a different risk of exposure, and only you can decide what level of precaution and inconvenience you're willing to take in order to protect your own private information. But I would encourage everyone, at the very least, to go to our surveillance self-defense webpage. It's at ssd.eff.org. And there'll be a specific page for activists or protesters looking to attend a protest.
Good advice. Stephanie, tell us, where are we procedurally with the inauguration?
I think the vast majority of them have already been arraigned and are at differing stages in the process. Some are still pre-preliminary hearing, some are post-preliminary hearing. I don't know to what degree they're going to be consolidating them. I'm not actually representing any individual client. I'm more trying to help the Criminal Defense Council litigate the issues of their client's digital privacy and protecting that.
Stephanie, what has your experience been generally at protest? Is this practice of seizing cell phones happening in other parts of the country? Is it new?
Well, I wouldn't want to say it's a general practice. I have heard of police seizing phones at protests, sometimes without even booking the owner of the phone for any violation. I'm aware of at least like Oakland Police Department here in California arrested a protester, seized her phone, separated her from her phone, and then only returned it after the protest. And there was some suspicion as to what the police did with her phone during the protest and what information they may have had access to from the phone, which was password protected. So this should serve as a caution that if you choose to participate in a protest, you may want to leave your phone at home if you don't want to risk police seizure or consider removing any sensitive information from the device.
Yes, and I like your suggestion of considering bringing a burner phone to the protest. But I think this all really underscores the importance of exercising good security protocol. And we can all start with that by following some of EFF's guidelines. Stephanie, it's been a real pleasure to have you on. We want to thank you and EFF in general for the excellent work that you continue to do. And we hope to stay in touch with you about the outcome of some of these cases.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.